Hello again, and welcome to It's Innate, a podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I'm Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton. And this is Innate. So this episode, we have the pleasure of interviewing my former grad school advisor. So what I've done is I've written a little bit of an introduction, so I'm going to read that, and then we'll get into the podcast. So it's my pleasure to introduce my former grad school advisor, our very first podcast guest, someone who I consider to be a good friend and colleague, and someone you'd sooner catch dead before catching in split an infinitive, the esteemed Dr. David Rackeson, who is an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. David received his Bachelor's of Science in Psychology from the University of Warwick in England, and then his Doctor of Philosophy from the University of Sussex, and he's laughing. David then did postdocs at the University of Texas at Austin and Concordia University before becoming a professor at CMU in Pittsburgh. In his research, David combines behavioral methods, and these include infant habituation, impaired preference, along with inductive inference techniques with children, with computational modeling to study topics that include infants developing capacity to distinguish animate entities from inanimate objects, including whether infants' categorization of such objects and entities is driven by perceptual or surface features or by deeper and non-obvious properties. And this work resulted in a 2008 SRCD monograph, which he co-authored with Gary Lupien, in which he argued that infants learn about the emotion properties of animates and inanimates through a domain general process called constrained attentional and associative learning. Finally, David and I have conducted research examining infants' ability to go beyond detecting direct associations between features that occur together to using a process called second-order correlation learning to detect the relation between features that are only indirectly correlated. And this work resulted in one publication in the Journal of Infancy and a study that's currently under review, a study that I co-authored with David and David, David Sobel and David Rackeson. So how's that for an introduction?
That was great. Thank you, Dion. Thanks for having me. Thank you, Candice. Yeah, you could work as my publicist, Dion.
That was
very nice.
Just if it's academia, you can work out.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Exactly. All right. So the plan for this episode, I mean, we really want to give the audience a chance to get to know you. So we have a few questions, but we want this to sort of be a free-flowing conversation. We said at the very beginning, we're happy that you, agreed to being, interviewed.
I'm honored and happy to be your first guest on the podcast.
Right, it's only fitting.
Excited to be
only
here.
Fitting.
I agree. I thought that it was. I'll start off in jumping in with being again not necessarily, no expert in infant research for sure. But so when I was chatting with Dion and he told me who his grad advisor was, I was like, oh, that name sounds familiar. Let me go back to what I'm teaching about in my classes. And of course, you're in my textbook and you're part of your work is part of the content that I teach about my infant cognition section. And so I was really interested to chat, especially about some of the things that we talk about in my class around infants' ability to form categories, perceptual categories and conceptual categories. And so I wanted to give you a snippet of what my textbook that I use, what it says about infant conceptual categories. And it says that based on some work by Mandler that it's about 7 to 9 months of age that infants form conceptual categories rather than just making perceptual discriminations between different categories. And the examples of these objects are around objects that do include motion. So airplanes versus birds as a category. And so when I was reading through some of your work too, it seems like that was maybe not the perspective or the conclusion that you came to. And so I was interested to hear what you thought about that.
Right. Well, so Gene did some really ingenious experiments back in the 80s and early 90s where she studied aspects of infant perception and cognition that hadn't been studied before, which is, what is the basis for categorization? And until Gene came along, people generally believed that there was this basic to superordinate shift, where babies and children learn superordinate categories before basic level categories. Basic level categories before superordinate level categories, which was largely based on Ellen Roche's work. And I think Gene's insight was to show that, in fact, superordinate categories are going to be formed before basic level categories. And to show this, she used the sequential touching task, where she would have four animals and four vehicles, and she would throw them, not throw them, but place them in front of a baby, and then measure which objects the baby touched.
She did throw them. Yeah, that would probably be the last study she would run.
Well, the babies are normally the ones who throw the toys, right?
Right, right.
So
among other things.
And what she found was that babies would sequentially touch the animals and then the vehicles, but they would not do so for categories like dogs versus cats or dogs versus horses. And so her conclusion was that babies, infants, categorize at the superordinate level, or what she called the global level, before the basic level. And I have no problem with that. I think that the data speak to that. But her reasoning for why for the basis of that categorization, I think, was erroneous. So she looked at her stimuli for animals versus vehicles, and she said, all of these animals look different. All of these vehicles look different. If babies are grouping them as the same thing, it can't be because of how they look, because the animals look different from each other and the vehicles look different. So it must be based on some conceptual, deeper understanding that animals are goal-directed and self-propelled and that vehicles are not. For my graduate work, I tested whether that was the case by taking parts, mutilating cattle, among other things, and taking legs off animals and taking wheels off vehicles and switching them over and all sorts of different manipulations. But the bottom line there was that it looked that rather than babies using some kind of conceptual category, they were simply grouping things together that had the same surface features. Things with legs, they belong together. Things with wheels belong together. Things with wings belong together. And even relatively subtle perceptual differences, perhaps like having eyes versus having no eyes, could be sufficient for babies to group these things over here and these things over here. So even though I agree with the conclusion that the superordinate or global category comes first, I don't think there's any direct evidence in Mandler's work that this is based on what she called conceptual categories.
Yeah, that makes sense. I found another connection between David and I now, which is that we've both mutilated toys in our research.
He didn't make the caveat, though. He said he just mutilated animals.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you clarified that these are toys. I
was just assuming. Toy, right. I did. Some of my graduate work was on the experience of guilt in young children. And so I had to like mutilate some toys to make them look like they were fully functioning. But then when kids played with them, they fell apart and then we made them feel guilty about it. So yeah, we did lots of prototypes of mutilating legs or wheels off of things. We settled on the head getting mutilated off of a dog for the biggest bang for our buck. So yeah.
Did you ever make children cry with that?
No. Surprisingly, not a single tear out of hundreds of participants.
I'm pleased to hear that. I'm very pleased to hear that. So, we could talk more about Mandler. I mean, so that was the sequential touching studies done by Mandler. The other type of studies done by Mandler were these inductive generalization studies. And she used these data to also make the claim that babies were using these conceptual categories to make these induction decisions. And in these tasks, let me give you an example. Babies would see at the baseline, the experimenter brings out two toys, let's say a dog and a car, and a prop like a key. And the baby's given the chance to interact with these toys without any cues, and generally they do nothing. You then take away the dog and the car, you leave the key, and you bring in a model exemplar like another vehicle, and you would show the baby that the car starts with the key. So they would put the key to the car and go, brum, brum. Now, the fact they used a sound that's connected to cars is also a bit of a cue or clue for babies, but let's ignore that for now. And so they would see the car starting with the key, quote-unquote starting with the key, and then it wouldn't be the other vehicle. Then they bring back the car and the animal, or the car and the dog, and they'd say, can you show me brum brum, with the key also there. And in that context, babies would take the key and put it to the car, the vehicle. And if you do it with something like drinking, where an animal was modeled drinking, and then they bring in a novel animal and a novel vehicle, now babies make the animal drink. And Mandler said, look, babies understand by 9 months of age that baby, that animals drink, that cars start with keys. Therefore, these must be conceptual categories. Now, the problem with that study is that maybe babies were simply looking at the exemplar that the experimenter held, the vehicle that they put the key to, or the animal that they put the cup to. Then they're given two options, one that looks like the object the experimenter held, one that doesn't, and asked to pick one. They're going to pick the one the experimenter held. And I've never actually tested this directly, whether babies are doing this matching hypothesis, but Barbara Younger and actually has a, I can't remember if it's a published paper or a poster, but she basically showed that if you model with the wrong thing, if you make an animal start with a key, then babies will imitate that. Animals will put a key to a novel animal. If you see a car drinking, they will put a cup to a novel vehicle.
Right, so just more of some type.
Although you have done some research looking at whether or not these inferences that infants make are in fact based on these sort of more deeper conceptual properies. I think what the paper was in 2007 or something like that. 2005, yeah. So in that study, I think you, so in that study, what you do is you give kids, animals with legs, animals without legs, with legs, mm-hmm. without legs. And the idea is that, if these inferences are based on these sort of obvious surface features, then infants should use, for example, things with legs. So it could be a piece of furniture, or it can be an animal. But if we're using something like conceptual property of the thing, they should make these inferences on the basis of the thing itself and not perceptual features. And so that work, I guess, sort of touches on.
Right. Exactly.
The study here.
Exactly. So, 14-month-olds, having seen a car roll or an animal hop, will pick another animal or another car as to imitate. But the next one they'll pick after that is something that has the appropriate parts. So they would, rather than pick a second animal that has no legs, having seen an animal sort of hopping or moving non-linearly, they will pick another object that has legs, even if it's not an animal, so a chair. So if you have babies hopping chairs across a table rather than a snail that has no legs. So yeah, I was more interested in looking at motion, how and when babies learn about motion properties. So I use that technique to study that. So overall, I think there's just very little evidence that infants have these conceptual categories, at least in the first year of life, which is something that Gene Mandel was really pushing for. And I think at this point, babies are mostly building up associations between different features, different motion properties, and when they see one, it triggers or primes or cues or whatever you want to use, the knowledge of the other. So if they see legs, that triggers knowledge of self-propulsion, maybe agency, and so on.
Yeah.
Here's a question that I want to ask you, because having done some of this mutilation myself, this is a question I've been asked. The question is, well, how do we know once you've done these mutilations that the infants are perceiving the stimuli in the way that you intend them to be perceived? So to give an example from my own work, we looked at the Spelke study in 95 mm-hmm. to examine to what extent infants do in fact espouse a core knowledge system. And one of the arguments I sort of made based on that work is that, well, maybe the inferences, that is, so in the study, as a reminder to for those who don't actually know the study, Spelke, Phillips, and Woodward conducted a study in 95 where they basically show infants video events of either people moving in the absence of physical contact or objects moving in the absence of physical contact. Now, I'm sort of simplifying the procedure, but that's more or less what happened. And what they find is that, the 7-month-olds look longer when objects move by themselves and not when people move by themselves. And on the basis of this similar findings, the argument is that, well, infants must be possessed from birth or shortly thereafter this innate core knowledge system that stipulates the principles that govern how objects and people move. The problem with that study is that, well, one, these are 7-month-olds, so they've had a full 7 months to learn about the relevant contingencies that distinguish objects from people, but more importantly, people have perceptual features that objects don't. Moreover, these features are often associated with certain movement properties. So legs are associated often with self-propelled motion, and so the pattern of looking that infants showed in that study may well have been driven by these low-level perceptual features. And so the idea is that if, in fact, the infants do possess this core knowledge system that allows them to distinguish between objects and people, it shouldn't matter whether the objects have people parts. And so if you put people parts in the objects, because they're still objects, they should treat them as such. And so when I show them an object, for example, with legs, they should still be surprised when it begins to move. Well, one pushback I received, which I think is a valid pushback, is, well, how do you know that the infants are seeing these things as objects? And so the same question, I guess, I can ask today, like, how do you know, like, when you've done these mutilation studies, how do we know that the infants are perceiving these things in the way that we intended them to perceive them? Like, what would your response be to something like that?
We're never going to know. Right, we can't literally peer inside an infant's mind. But what we can say is that under some conditions, so for example, in my very first publication, which is Raxon and Butterworth, 1998, infants, if you take, for example, legs and wheels off animals and vehicles, they no longer categorize them as different. So right now, your in terms of your question, it looks like we couldn't answer that. If you give everything legs and wheels, if all animals have legs and wheels and all vehicles have legs and wheels, they also don't categorize them as different. Same problem. But if you have half of the stimuli have legs, like half of the animal, the two animals with legs and two vehicles with legs, and two vehicles with wheels and two vehicles or two animals with wheels. Now, depending on how they group them, that can tell you what features they're focusing on. So they might not see them as animals, but it tells you that the basis for categorization is feature X or feature Y or neither. So in that case, 14-month olds would group things that have legs together and things that have wheels, regardless of whether animals and vehicles. So I'm not sure it matters so much that they see it as a real animal or a real vehicle. I think the reason we do this is to see whether these features, these properties, are sufficient to act as the basis for categorization.
Exactly.
I think it's also worth bearing in mind that babies, you know, as adults, we feel like we've seen more or less everything there is to see, right? If we walked down the street and all of a sudden there was a dog with a giraffe neck, we would be freaked out because we've been around a while, me longer than you, obviously, but we haven't seen such things. But for babies, every day they're seeing new things. Every day they're encountering objects they've never seen before. So they might find something surprising in the sense that it's novel, but it's unlikely that they're going to, at least early on, experience something and refuse to accept it as some category member, because it's just some new thing they've not encountered before. And so maybe there are cars that have animal heads, and maybe there are, you know, animals that have wheels. Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's possible.
I mean, some animals have wheels. If they're missing their
some
legs.
Animals, that is true.
That's true.
And they are still animals.
It's a real thing.
And if you take the wheels off my car, it's still a car. Not a very functional car.
It's a useless car, but it's still a car.
But for babies, they don't have such rigid expectation. They don't have, you know, as far as we can tell.
So my answer is actually, the answer I typically give is more or less similar to that. And so the answer I typically give is one way. So you're right. You can't really know what the infants are perceiving these objects to be. But there are things you can do to determine what aspect, what portion of the stimuli they're attending to. And so because the study that I was referencing involves 7-month-olds, one thing you can do is to do a simple discrimination study.
Right.
And so the idea is you would habituate them to an unmutilated, for example, or maybe a mutilated person or an object. So like you would habituate them to a stimulus that has a person upper half and an object bottom half. And then you would test them with that pair next to an unmutilated person. And the idea is if, for example, they treat them similarly, what that suggests, of course, is that they're attending to the upper half, right? Because the upper half didn't change.
Yeah.
Now, if they dishabituate, if they look longer at the unmutilated stimulus, what that suggests is that they're attending to these low-level perceptual features. That's not a problem for me, because in fact, if anything, that's precisely what I'm arguing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm arguing that the basis of this longer looking, that is looking longer when an object moves by itself, is because the objects lack these features that therefore don't instigate this expectation of self-propelled motion.
Exactly.
And so that it's an important question, but it's not something that's insurmountable, mm-hmm. just like Dave mm-hmm. is mentioning. So there are ways to get at this.
Yeah. But I think the bigger right. issues here are about the mechanisms. Like you guys have mentioned core right. knowledge systems. I think that's clearly the... am I jumping?
It's right. okay. I'm interested, and I don't want to regress to topics we've already discussed on previous episodes, but this also is bringing up for me, if we return to our listserv discussion for just a second, because I feel like part of what you're describing and like infant sensitivity to just perceptual features of objects and what they might mean is inherent to part.
Are you familiar
oh, with yeah, this sorry.
Discussion, by the way, David? So maybe, do you want to provide some context, Candy?
Which list are you talking about? The
yes,
puppets?
The theory of puppets.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm
oh, okay.
The puppets.
Okay,
The now infamous theory of puppets. And so, again, for mm-hmm. somebody who's interested in social cognition, I think that that's what we have come down to is this conversation about, like, do children and infants make the same inferences or have the same understanding of what a puppet is doing, like the actions or the thoughts of a puppet or these different, you know, dolls or whatever toys we're using for these social cognition tasks? And it's really interesting because I think that it is sort of related to what you all are talking about, because these puppets have perceptual features that look like humans, mm-hmm. but do we then mm-hmm. assign them the same you know, characteristics or traits as humans? Do we really think that they have their own thoughts or beliefs?
Right.
I don't know. Any thoughts on that for somebody who studies motion?
Well, I think that the conversation has been really interesting. I've been keeping track of it. I think it depends a lot on the age that we're talking about. I think, you know, because theory of mind, without a theory of mind, It's hard to imagine that infants, well, depending who you talk to about theory of mind, it's hard to imagine that infants really believe that these puppets have their own beliefs, goals, desires. That's my take.
Once it's just hard to reconcile that with, so I don't mean to cut you off, but it's hard to reconcile that view with the fact that these kids, and this is I'm sort of parroting more or less what Michael Frank said in the thread. He was saying, well, how do you explain the systematicity in their responses, mm-hmm. which is a good question. Like, if you're not tapping theory of mind, which makes certain predictions, that is, it predicts that babies or kids will respond in certain ways and not others, how do you explain the systematicity in their responses?
Right.
Not
tapping? Is there always systematicity in their responses? We haven't gotten to that.
We haven't gotten to that episode yet.
But, and again, I think we're talking really right, about differences right. across... Like, when we say theory of mind, like, there are people that study, just like David said, depending on age, like, theory of mind from, mm-hmm. like, Kylie Hamlin's work with geometric shapes with googly eyes, all the mm-hmm. way up through, like, Henry Wellman's work with using vignettes with preschoolers, and all the way up through yep. middle-aged children. So, like, there's a big difference probably in many of those tasks as well, and what we might expect kids to understand or know. And whether or not there is systematicity in findings, I don't know. It probably depends on the task and the age that we're talking about.
Right. But Kylie's work can be explained more in terms of goals. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, these objects have a goal. But you don't have to infer an understanding of intention, right? There's a difference between understanding goals or having goals and having intentions, right? If I see a hand reaching for a bottle, I can infer that the goal of the hand... Not necessarily the mind. The goal of the hand is to change the state of the bottle. But it doesn't mean I necessarily understand that there's a mind behind the goal that sorted out. So, or sort as in S-O-U-G-H-T, right? So, not S-O-R-T. So, I think that in Kylie's work, and you can ascribe that to goal-directed action, potentially, without needing to... ascribe it to this kind of deeper intentional theory of mind understanding. Whereas I think the older work, Henry's work, obviously, and others, there you it's more about maybe desires and beliefs and intentions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to discriminate those two to some degree. And I think in these puppet studies, I think younger babies might expect things to have goals, but not necessarily understand that there are intentions, there are thoughts behind the goal. So it's a somewhat subtle distinction, but I think it's important to make. So like in the Woodward studies, I don't think there's any evidence of it. It's not intentional directed action. It's goal-directed action. And I think that's an important discrimination that needs to be made, distinction.
Yeah, that does seem important, and I think we use those interchangeably when we start to use social stimuli.
Right. But I think you can understand that something has a goal without necessarily knowing that there's a being, an intentional being behind that goal-directed action.
This sort of touches on something that Candy and I were discussing for the weekend. Like, in order to be able to get at whether or not they're inferring intention, which is of the mind, you would have to manipulate these things separately, right? Mm-hmm. And show that, you know, in one condition they respond according to intentionality. Like if the claim you want to make is that they're responding to not goal necessarily, but to intention, which I think again is an important distinction, you have to show that in these different manipulations that they respond systematically to intention,
right?
Ignoring goal.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert in this work, so I can't tell you if these manipulations have been done. But like, in order to be able to make these claims, these sorts of things have to be done.
Right. Well, Andy Meltzer has this great study where he shows 18-month-olds actions where they try to, where, for example, an adult tries to put a hook, a ring on a hook, right? So the adult reaches for the hook with the ring and they miss the hook and the ring falls on the floor. And then kids are asked to imitate this. And the question is, are they going to imitate the dropping the ring on the floor, which is what they actually saw? Are they going to imitate putting the ring on the hook? And that's what they do. And there I feel like the intention might start to come into things a little bit more. That's sort of separating the goal maybe from the intention, because they don't see the action completed. But that's a whole other discussion, I guess.
Yeah.
Sounds like you need a Theory of Mind podcast at some point.
Right. Or an episode, which we plan on having, I guess, the next episode or one of the
Sometime soon we'll have more in-depth discussions there. Yeah,
totally. Right. Now, let's actually get into the topic which people are tuning in to listen to, which is sort of innateness. And so the question I want to ask David is what his take on innateness is, what his take on the domain general versus domain specific mechanism debate is, and how his work has contributed to this debate.
If you could just solve the whole thing for us right now.
Solve it all right now.
No.
Yes, innateness.
We're done.
That contravenes everything I know about you.
Well, okay, so let me ask you a question. What do you mean by innateness?
I mean, so in the context that we're using innateness, we mean that's unlearned. So to give an example, I mentioned the work by Spelke, Phillips, and Woodward. So there, the claim is that this knowledge that people and objects espouse different causal properties is supposed to be innate. That is, it's present from birth, it's not learned.
Right. Okay.
And again, the argument I made against that particular claim, that may well be true, but the study that is reported doesn't justify that conclusion, precisely because, again, these are 7-year-olds, yada, yada, yada. So what we mean by innateness, or at least what I mean by innateness, is a certain kind of knowledge, or certain knowledge that's unlearned, it shows up early,
Right. So I'm in a department that's grounded in empiricism, right? So most of my colleagues believe that the mechanisms that we have and that we use to learn about the world are what you would call domain general mechanisms. I'm sort of on the continuum, I think, between domain general and domain specific. I think that when it comes to aspects of cognition that people that I study, that you study, Dion, maybe that Candice studies, I think that most of the mechanisms that we use are domain general, and that I think there is relatively little what you would call innate knowledge. And my reasoning for this, so let me back up. Rochelle Gelman, among others, has made the argument that the reason that this innateness has occurred and that exists and the specialized mechanisms for learning exist is because the environment has been regular for millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years. Objects have always fallen until they hit a flat surface. 1 + 1 has always been 2. And so the argument is, well, because it's always been like that, why have babies learn it? Why not just build it into the system so that babies don't need to learn it? Because it's a standard, it's a default. 1 + 1 is always 2. My take on that is that the statistical regularities are so strong, 1 + 1 is always 2, objects always fall till they hit a horizontal surface, that it doesn't take very long for babies to extract those statistical regularities from the world. And, you know, anyone who runs habituation studies know that within, you know, 4 to 16 trials, you can teach babies just about anything in the lab. Just about anything. Candice is laughing about my habituation.
No, I just, I mean, it's just the, you know, the way that we think about topics sometimes so differently. And it's like, you know, this idea that, well, on one side, somebody could believe that, well, because things always happen this way, then it must be something that we, you know, we just now has become innate within us over time. Right. Whereas on the other hand, it's like, oh, well, you know, I can also just teach somebody this in like 10 trials of a task. And so that would also be sufficient to explain the same exact thing.
Exactly.
Or you have people making the exact both arguments at once. So the person that comes in mind, I'm not going to mention the person my name, but this idea of original sin. So on the one hand, the environment is regular, but on the other hand, the world consists of many, many correlations. How do we know which ones to attend to? You can't have your cake and eat it too, or you can't eat your cake and have it too. That's really how it should be said.
Yeah, it should be said like that. So, but Brooke, I still think that, you know, like, again, let's go back to gravity. I mean, babies are seeing objects dropped. You assume that babies, they're in their crib, they're being held, they're seeing objects fall, and every time they fall, they keep going until they hit a horizontal surface. You'd imagine that babies could quickly learn that that's how things work, how gravity works. Not they have a real concept of gravity, but yeah, if something is unsupported, it will fall until it is supported. So I feel that in that world, which is most of the core knowledge world, the math, you know, the Karen Wynn stuff, the math stuff, which I know you've talked about before, the object physics work, I feel like all of that could easily be picked up without any predetermined knowledge or pre-existing knowledge or even specialized mechanisms.
Yeah, like babies can learn that things fall to the ground from their 5 seconds sitting in a high chair throwing the same thing onto the floor.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and if you believe, as Piaget's, you know, said, that babies are little scientists, then that's what they're doing when they're throwing their objects off their high chair, is like, oh, that fell. Like nothing falls up. Nothing like thing goes up when they drop it. So, but now, you know, Dion knows this. I said that I'm, you know, I'm on the continuum, so to speak, on the spectrum, because I think that there are other areas, other domains in which, you know, extracting regularities is insufficient. And so I've done some work on babies learning about snakes and spiders. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one domain in which the statistics, learning through statistical learning or extracting regularities, does not benefit the child. So imagine you have to, the only way to find out that a snake can kill you is by being bitten by it. That's simply not adaptive.
No.
So it's not. I mean, like, oh, that thing bit me, now I'm dead. Well, it's hard to learn when you're dead. So, and you know, I think there are some domains in which we do potentially have what, you know, some kind of knowledge without experience, that we have specialized mechanisms where the potential cost for learning slowly is relatively high. So heights would be a good example. Snakes would be a good example. Typically, the things that humans have that are highest on the list of fears tend to be things that I think that we maybe have some pre-existing sort of biases at the very least, to help get the baby off the ground and avoid potential death early on. But I think for these other domains like physics and math, where the environment is extremely structured, I feel like that these domain general mechanisms and the absence of pre-existing knowledge or innate knowledge, I think that's more likely.
That's an interesting one for you to bring up too, because I'm very interested in infant perceptual development around depth perception. And so even though, again, not my area, I've always loved Karen Adolph's work.
I was going to ask, how do you reconcile your view with...
She probably wouldn't really say that either. A lot of her work shows that there's sort of developmental curves again and again of children not really showing any type of fear of heights.
Right.
It's a function of how much experience they have in certain positions, right?
Yes.
So a baby with a lot of crawling experience will be hesitant to crawl over an edge, but as soon as the baby starts walking, they'll sort of just as happily walk over the edge. So how do you reconcile your view with that particular finding?
The even if you posit that babies have innate knowledge or pre-existing biases, it doesn't necessarily mean that no experience is necessary. So I'm not claiming that babies come into the world fearful of snakes or spiders. That I don't believe that the fear is innate, but I think that these specialized mechanisms make it that so that you more quickly learn that these things are things to be feared. And I think in the case of heights, it's probably something similar where you need less trials to learn. When your life is on the line, you should need less trials to learn than when you're just learning that 1 + 1 is
right.
2.
Yeah, no.
Right? One is more relevant to survival. And, you know, adaptive pressures, selection pressures, you know, work pretty strongly where life is on the line, where basically survival or reproduction are on the line.
I think there's evidence there, too, for that because, you know, so, for example, when an infant is crawling, the danger of certain, like, a fall force, an infant that's crawling might not be very high versus, like, if when you're standing up and locomoting, that falling over from that position, and especially mm-hmm. the older that you get, the more dangerous it is to fall. And so we talk about...
Well, yes and no, because as you get older, you have more upper body strength to support yourself. I mean, I'm clumsy. I fall over a lot. So, you know, and I have upper body strength to at least try and stop my fall, whereas babies have less. So even my 8-year-old stepson doesn't have much upper body strength. So when he goes down hard.
Yeah. But if an infant's crawling, they might be more likely to say, like, try to crawl up something that's steeper than somebody who's locomoting mm-hmm. on two legs, where that might seem more dangerous.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you know, I think having said all that, I doubt anyone's read my book. I also think that this discussion of sort of domain general versus domain specific is a little short-sighted. I think it's really likely, I don't think anyone would deny that we have specialized mechanisms. So attachment, anyone who doesn't believe in specialized mechanisms just has to look at attachment. Attachment is an evolved specialized mechanism to form this enduring long-term bond with a caretaker or a child, depending on who you are. That's a specialized mechanism. It's there just for that job. So I think it's really unlikely that we only have domain general mechanisms. We only have specialized mechanisms. In all likelihood, we have both. And the real question for me is what would have caused the emergence of these domain specific versus domain general, you know, over domain general mechanisms. My assumption is that our common ancestor shared these domain general mechanisms with us. There was a common ancestor that had already evolved. You know, statistical learning, habituation, conditioning, imitation, right? And we can see most of these abilities in our close relatives, genetically speaking. So my assumption is that these specialized mechanisms were species specific, that each species then developed these specialized mechanisms for the adaptive problems that they were facing. And we face different adaptive problems to some species. And so we have specialized mechanisms that they might not have. So I think that I also think that anything that we do, whether it's being habituated in, you know, as an infant or playing with toys in a theory of mind task, we're bringing to bear domain general mechanisms and domain specific mechanisms at the cognitive level, but we're also bringing to bear lots of specialized and general mechanisms at lower levels, at the perceptual level, at the visual level. So, and this is something that Lisa Oakes and I talked about in our book, Developmental Cascades. There's the idea that it's maybe short-sighted to think about any behavior being driven by just one kind of mechanism, because, you know, every behavior, every thought is affected by different kinds of mechanisms across multiple levels and across multiple domains.
Yep. So I think this is what we were talking about last level, time, too. Yeah.
Yep, we were. And for me, the question is, so yeah, I guess on the one hand, the question is, what sorts of evolutionary pressures existed to give rise to, for example, domain-specific mechanisms? For me, the question that's interesting is not whether or not we're born with mechanisms, because of course we are. We're not, you know, hardcore empiricists, you know, and learning itself wouldn't happen if we didn't have any mechanisms at all. For me, the interesting question is, what's the nature of the knowledge that these mechanisms give rise to? And how rich is this knowledge? Mm-hmm. And if you speculate, or if you posit the existence of rich knowledge, the question you then have to answer is, well, the world itself is regular. So why would you need to possess the, you know, sort of rich knowledge about, for example, the motion properties of things.
Right. Well,
you can just as easily learn that through the environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree, obviously. But, I think it depends what you think is being built in. Right, so there's plenty of evidence that babies at birth have some very simple perceptual biases. Right, they prefer looking at large things over small things. They prefer looking at moving things over static things. Excuse me, and that right there gets the baby quite a long way in terms of what they're going to look at and learn about. So you talked about spurious correlations before. It's not that babies look at the world and everything is equally salient. Even yep. from birth, some things are more salient than others, and those salient things are going to be learned about more quickly than the non-salient things. So, you know, you can posit, some people have posited rich knowledge, but I think that, you know, my sort of take on the presence of what you've been calling innate knowledge, or, you know, is more that there are these simple biases, and the simple biases are all that you need to direct infants to learn about some things more readily than others. So I certainly, when it comes to snakes and spiders, I've suggested that maybe babies have a perceptual template that specifies very generally what these things look like, but they still need, and they also have a mechanism that rapidly associates those stimuli when they see them with the response of a conspecific, typically. You know, someone screams, there's a snake in the room, someone screams, babies quickly learn snake equals, you know, negative emotional response, if you call it that. So I think just some simple biases, rather than babies being born with a rich knowledge that snakes are dangerous, because in many places, like where I grew up, snakes are not dangerous, right? There's no, literally not a single dangerous snake in England that can hurt you, but people have plenty of fears and phobias of snakes in England, even though there's nothing dangerous about them. So mm-hmm. I think that you don't need to have this sort of rich knowledge, just some very simple biases are sufficient, in my opinion.
I think this is an important point that's often overlooked, and this plays itself out in many domains. You know, the domain that David and I know very well is the causal perception domain. And even in that domain, we know from work with recent work with newborn infants that babies prefer to, or they look longer at direct launching events. These are the prototypical causal events. And the reason why, of course, is that these direct launching events have motion properties that you don't find in other events. One of the key motion properties that they have is continuous motion. And so what this suggests, of course, and the fact that these are newborns, suggests that babies have a bias to attend to continuous motion. And this may well make it such that the direct launching event comes to be privileged. And so, you know, finding, showing that babies perceive or they distinguish causal events from non-causal events, which they group together, may well be the result of this initial bias to attend to events that contain continuous motion. This may well be another bias. And this bias, again, like David was saying, helps to organize the world in ways that you may not have thought originally. So I agree.
We seem very much on the same page.
Well, we don't.
Yeah.
There are other domains like mating, where mm-hmm. I think there are very strong biases. Right, where, you know, some people think that men and women have different preferences, yeah, heterosexual men and women, that would be, have different biases because of culture, that we're reading, you know, I don't know what magazines people read these days, GQ,
people still read magazines.
Vogue. Yeah, I don't even think people still read magazines. But the argument is, you watch TV, you watch movies, you read magazines, that tells you what a good mate looks like. But from an evolutionary psychology perspective, which is essentially the core knowledge perspective translated to everything, these biases are built in because over evolutionary time, people who mated randomly would not out-reproduce and out-survive people who mated selectively and picked mm-hmm. mates that were, you know, either fecund, who were fertile, if you're a man looking for a woman, or who were good resource generators, if you're a man. So I think in some domains, these biases can be relatively specified somehow. Now, people often say, well, how is this specified in the genes? And I say, I have no idea, but that doesn't mean it's not. right? Like many people, some people have argued, well, if you can't tell us how to specify the genes, then your argument is fallacious. But I think just because we don't understand how that works, just like we don't understand how consciousness arises from the brain, mm-hmm. doesn't mean there is no consciousness. It just means we don't understand it yet.
Certainly not. And in fact, this actually gets into a question I wanted to ask you, which is, how do you identify mechanisms? So you're right, that one argument people often make is, well, if you can't describe or explicate the nature of the mechanism, the nature of the where in the genes this particular bias would emerge, then you're right, the argument is quite fallacious. But I take that argument to be quite silly itself on its face. And there are things you can do to isolate or to determine the locus of a bias or the locus of a particular ability. And so this leads to the next question, which is, how does one go about identifying mechanisms? So I want to be clear, there's two kinds of mechanisms. There's sort of internal mechanisms in the mind, like associative learning, statistical learning, limitation, and there's outward mechanisms, like, for example, intervention. And we know, I keep referring to the causal literature because that's my area of expertise, and we know that in the causal domain, if you give kids, if you allow them to intervene in the causal system, they're better able to learn the causal structure than if you prevent kids from doing that. And so intervention itself is a mechanism that you can readily manipulate. But something like associative learning, it's not clear how you infer the existence of something like associative learning, and to go back to David's point, the existence of these biases in the genes. So how does one go about identifying mechanisms? We talk about mechanisms, but how does one go about identifying these cognitive mechanisms? These less obvious mechanisms.
I think that's one of the hardest questions that developmentalists, cognitive psychologists, just generally
right.
face. I
mean, right. it's solve it for us.
Yeah, I wish I could.
I really we don't do. Need this podcast anymore.
I mean, yeah.
Right.
You
this
know,
is this is the last episode.
Yeah, that's right. We'll solve all the problems of the world.
Right. Just as we get started, we stop.
I think this is something that the developmentalists have been struggling with for years. I think it's there is no real answer for that. I think that many of the studies that people conduct to try and test for mechanism are sufficiency arguments. I can show that babies can learn through pure association, because if all I do is present them with two features to learn and they learn that those two features go together, we assume that's an associative mechanism. But being able to discriminate what we think of as a specialized mechanism, a core knowledge system from a non-core knowledge system, at this point, I'm not sure there are good methods to do this. Now, I wrote a paper in a Journal of Cognition Development called How to Identify a Domain General Mechanism When You See One. And there we do have some ideas for what might look like. What data, for example, might look like a domain general mechanism or might not? So, for example, one of the arguments is that domain general mechanisms might give rise to non-monotonic learning curves. That is, and in some domains we do see, like, you know, think about perceptual narrowing, for example. One argument is that's clearly the result of experience, right? That you can't have perceptual narrowing unless you have experience of a certain stimulus, which then, you know, limits what you're able to discriminate in the case of phonemes, for example. So there you can see the effect.
All the past tense debate.
All the past tense debate, yeah. So there you can see the effect of experience on learning where it's non-monotonic. Whereas I think most, for example, specialized mechanisms would not make the prediction that learning, they would make the prediction that learning should be somewhat linear, right? Or should show a continued increase. But I think, you know, others have argued against that claim. And I think it's one of the toughest questions is how to identify whether some behavior is being driven by essentially a domain general or domain specific mechanism. As I said before, I think the argument might be a little bit moot. I've been arguing about this for many years now, and at some level, I think, as I said before, there's no way that domain general and domain specific mechanisms aren't involved in just about everything we do. Maybe at different levels, maybe like at the cognitive level, we might think of it as more domain general, but at the visual level or perceptual level, we have specialized photoreceptors, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that a specialized mechanism or a general mechanism, right? Or is it even a mechanism?
Yeah.
The other thing I would ask you, Dion, and this came up when I was writing my book with Lisa, is how do you define mechanism? Because we talk about mechanism a lot, but it's ill-defined in the literature.
So I want to make before answering that question, I want to sort of make a point to your point, which mm-hmm. is that My question about how to identify mechanisms is actually a bit more basic than whether or not multiple mechanisms can be operating at once. I mean, of course, that's true. The world is a complex place, and lots of factors are playing out. So let's see. Having a little bit of technical difficulties. One second. There we go. Yeah, so for me, the question is, how do you identify mechanism? And I think your answer touches on at least how I think about it. So just like the way we go about testing theory and corroborating, to use Karl Popper's term, corroborating a theory, we have a theory, we have hypotheses, and we have predictions. To the extent that the data are consistent with the predictions, you have some evidence in favor of the theory. Of course, you can never prove the theory because you can't possibly see all possible things. And so in the same way, mechanisms make, especially these cognitive, these more elusive mechanisms, make predictions. And to the extent that the babies respond in ways that are consistent with the predictions, you have evidence, perhaps, that the mechanism that you're talking about is at play. Now, again, that doesn't mean that that's the only mechanism, but again, my question is more basic. How do you identify mechanism? And one way to identify mechanism is to explicate the predictions that this kind of mechanistic account would make.
Right, so in many cases, different views make the same predictions, right? Let's say you're Liz Belke versus your Dion Benton, right? Mm-hmm. And you're making predictions about which you happen to be. It's
not hard to imagine.
Luck would have it.
Right.
So you know, you can pick studies about object physics or about, you know, the Spelke, Phillips and Woodward, you know, 95 paper. What different predictions would you make from one perspective versus the other? Like, what would you say the domain general perspective prediction is, and what would you say?
Well, I've already outlined a clear distinction in prediction. So if Spelke, so to go back to the people object event, mm-hmm. stuff, you know, if in fact Spelke is right that babies, you know, they're born with these core knowledge systems, one of them being a core knowledge system that stipulates the principles that govern agents, people, and one that governs the properties and the causal properties of objects, then she would predict that irrespective of perceptual manipulation, they should treat them distinctly. Whereas the account that I'm sort of testing is maintains that babies, the mechanism that they use to distinguish between these two object kinds is associative. And so because it's associative, what they're doing is, at least in that context, they're associating particular features. Now, that account, of course, predicts that the extent to which infants discriminate these two object kinds fundamentally depends on the perceptual features. So on the one hand, Spelke might argue that, no, that it shouldn't matter, whereas I'm arguing that, no, in fact, it does matter. So there's a clear case where we have mechanistic explanations that make completely different predictions. And in the case of, to answer your question now, in the case of multiple mechanisms predicting the same thing, well, then you have to ask the question is, which account is more parsimonious? If one of the mechanisms, I think about this from a computational modeling perspective. I mean, if I can explain behavior X using far fewer parts than my colleague, then why, like, what's the utility in positing the existence of a more complex mechanism when a simpler mechanism suffices? So even still, that would be my response to that. I mean, there's still ways to determine the viability of a mechanistic account, even if the mechanistic accounts make the same prediction. You look at parsimony.
But you could use your parse.
I think too that, like, as our theories develop and become more complex over time too, that we would be able to parse apart some type of way to measure when these two theories would make different predictions. And so even mm-hmm. though you might not know that now, you might know it in the future. The other thing that I was wanting to say was just that I agree with you, and I obviously, about the idea that we have these domain general and domain specific processes happening probably in parallel at the same time. But then I think it always comes down to the question of, like, but we still then want to know, right? Like, even though we know, like, these things are both happening, it doesn't eliminate our interest in the question, which I'm sure, obviously, you continue to have interest in. Your research addresses mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. like, trying right. to parse apart, at least in some way, like, when are these different processes happening, under what conditions, does one matter more than another, like, how do they come about? And so even though we might come to that conclusion in the end that, yeah, these things are still happening, it doesn't mean then, well, we're good, right? Like, now we just have to stop researching to this because sure. it's just going to be both of them nevertheless. We still want to try and mm-hmm. parse apart when these things are happening and which ones might right. be more privileged in a certain context.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and I also think we haven't talked about this, but computational modeling, which Dion knows a fair bit about, is a good way to attack this problem. Now, it yep. can only, it's only ever a sufficiency argument, mm-hmm. but if you can show that a PVP model, for example, can exhibit behavior that looks just like a baby or a child with very few pre-existing assumptions, it's a good sufficiency argument that that's what's going on in the brain. Now, we don't know that's what's going on, but
to me, that's interesting. To me, that itself is the most uninteresting aspect about computational modeling.
Fair enough.
So let me be clear. So it's one thing to simulate behavior, to say, "Hey, I built the model that does exactly what my infants do," but it's something altogether different than to do that in addition to building a model that makes predictions that are then confirmed.
Oh, of course.
That to me is the power of computational modeling, absolutely. Especially when you're looking at mechanism. So it's like I have this mechanism that can explain what the data I currently have. This mechanism it goes on to make these predictions that we test in subsequent behavioral studies, and we have evidence for. Now, that, I think, really starts to allow us to get at mechanism. It's another way of attacking a mechanism. To answer David's question about what the hell a mechanism is to begin with, well, I think a mechanism is a kind of cause, right? I mean, so the definition that I use depends on the kind of mechanism we're talking about. So I think the world can roughly be divided into two. Different kinds of mechanisms. We have these external mechanisms like intervention, Katie, you've done stuff looking at the effect of room type on upward social comparison. That's a kind of mechanism. And then you have these more internal mechanisms. Now, for the external mechanisms like intervention, the way I would define those kind of mechanisms are processes that give rise to the cause certain behavior. So in the case of intervention, that's a mechanism that allows kids to learn about causal structure. It causes them to sort of infer structure. Whereas these internal or abstract mechanisms, I think it's harder to define those because by virtue of the fact that they're abstract.
But what do these mechanisms have in common? So for me, a mechanism is simply, it takes an input, it computes over that input, mm-hmm. and it pulls, yep. and it sends, and it provides an output. That's yep. what a mechanism does, mm-hmm. right? I'm not sure if that works for what you're calling external mechanisms, but for internal mechanisms, for cognitive mechanisms, that's what it is. And an insight, the computation occurs by some process. That's what processes are. The processes do the computations yep. within the mechanism.
No, I think that would be completely consistent with an external mechanism. I mean, like the intervention is operating over data.
Right.
This intervention transforms the data in a way that makes sense. In a way that makes sense for the learner. Mm-hmm. So it is a mechanism that I don't know if it's taking in data, but it's at least operating on data, on the real world data, and producing responses that allow the data to have a bit more coherence than it otherwise would in the absence of that mechanism.
Right.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, I'm interested in our best question that Dion asked me last time that I was, which was just this, you know, to take to the point of our podcast and talking about things that are innate. If you were to you could wave your magic wand and have whatever evidence you wanted to prove to you that mm-hmm. something was indeed innate in the sense that we've talked about it in the podcast. What evidence would convince you that some ability or knowledge or whatever it is we've been talking about is actually innate to put you on the spot?
Just take your categorization stuff with Mandler as an example. Like, what evidence would you need to be able to say that their categorizations of these superordinate kinds is in fact
innate? Yeah, and it might be specific, or it could be something very general.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any for this, the Mandler stuff. I'm not sure there is. Again, it depends what you mean by innate. I mean, do babies certainly don't come into the world with innate categories, right?
So puberty is innate, but of course it takes a bit of input. So what we mean by innate is like the knowledge in question can be tapped and be shown from the very outset, or at least
Then you're testing newborns, right? Then you're Mark Johnson with babies on your lap, testing how long they track a face. You're Slater or Bremner testing to see whether babies within minutes of birth can associate two features or prefer some features over others. Certainly testing at birth is one way to go. It's very time consuming and hard to do.
No, I think that sounds really easy. Just brand new newborn infants, very simple population to get.
Right. I have a lot of undergrads who say, why don't you test newborns? I say, it's not easy.
That's a great idea. I've never done that.
I've never thought about that. So, but I don't think there's pretty much, I'm not sure there's anything else, anything any study I could do that would really provide me with strong evidence that something is quote unquote innate, right? I mean, you know, let's say you do a paired preference test. You put two things up on the screen for a newborn or a week old, and they prefer one to the other. Maybe that means that they have an innate preference, right? It's for moving over static things, as I said before. I'm not sure there's anything in the cognitive world where we're talking about categorization or causality or any of those where I think there's any evidence that because I don't believe any of these things are innate, that you could actually show that these things are quote-unquote innate. And as you said, I'm not really sure what innate even means. I mean, present without experience works for me better, but then as you said, puberty, you've got to have experience. You've got to be alive to hit puberty, right? So that it technically is not what we call innate. So I generally, in my writings, just... I try to avoid using the word innate. I think it's very laden with all sorts of interpretations different people have. So I will say present without experience. I will talk about specialized mechanisms. I'll talk about pre-existing biases, which you might think of as innateness. I'm not sure. I'd have to think, but I'm not sure there's anything any study I could do that would suddenly reveal that something is quote unquote innate. And as I said, I think that word is a bad word. Not because I don't believe necessarily that there is some things that are present without experience, but I feel like the word itself is confusing and opaque and is interpreted differently by lots of different people. So that's why I don't... But your podcast wouldn't be as exciting if it was called It's Present Without Experience Podcast.
It's Present From Birth or Shortly Thereafter.
Without Experience Podcast. Yeah, it's not quite as catchy, so I wouldn't recommend changing. But I do have this problem with this innateness, and I think the literature has moved away from it, maybe in response to Jeff Ellman and others' book back in the 90s. But you don't see people talking about innateness as much these days, right? It is much more about, you know, biases that might be present at birth, domain general versus domain specific mechanisms, which incidentally people think of domain specific mechanisms as innate and domain general ones as not innate, but of course they're all present at birth if you believe in domain specific mechanisms, right? So saying that one is innate and the other one isn't is also a little bit ridiculous, right? Specialized mechanisms and domain general mechanisms are both innate, if you want to use that phrase, although of course you can have emergent specialized mechanisms. David Buss, my friend David Buss and I were talking about this the other day in terms of, he said, do you have an iPhone? I said, yeah. He said, do you have apps on your iPhone? I said, sure. He said, well, we can think about the apps as different mechanisms. Here's my phone. Right? We can think about the apps as different mechanisms. And I said, yeah, I think we have these different mechanisms to do different things. The real question for me is, does within each app, do you have domain general mechanisms within each app, or is there that the OS has domain general mechanisms that act on each app? And he was okay with that idea, right? So to me, the idea is, I think we specialized mechanisms do seem to be an emergent property of learning, right? Face, you know, specialization is, you know, we become face experts. Some people think we have a specialized face area, some don't. But it seems that there are other cases in which we become specialized, become experts. And the real question for me is, regardless of whether that's a specialized mechanism or not, where what you know these domain general mechanisms are they within that mechanism, or are they mm-hmm. are they operating, like I said, like a phone? Are they is it in the OS? And that you use habituation and conditioning on that specialized mechanism, and maybe what really separates the how they work within on that specialized mechanism is, for example, to use a computational modeling example, that the learning rate might be faster for some mm-hmm. mechanisms than others, mm-hmm. right? Or that the input might be more salient for some mechanisms than others. So, you know, that's kind of how I like to think about it. So again, I'm trying to move away from this, it's one or the other, and yeah. more think about how these mechanisms work in tandem together.
I like that analogy.
Your iPhone analogy is very yeah. interesting, which incidentally, analogy is interesting. But it's beside the point. Your iPhone analogy is interesting because it makes a certain prediction, right? So like if we view the iPhone itself is espousing domain general processes that give rise to these specific apps, for example, well then that suggests that the iPhone is that these apps wouldn't exist in the absence of, right? So you need domain general mechanisms to give rise to general mechanisms to give rise to in that context.
Right.
And that's another way of
can't have an app without
in tandem,
a phone.
Essentially. Yeah. Right.
Well so David Buss used to tell me there's no such thing as a domain general mechanism. And I say, well, what about conditioning or statistical learning? And his argument was, well, within each specialized mechanism, you have conditioning. So you have conditioning for mating and conditioning for parenting and conditioning for this. And so more recently, we had this discussion about the iPhone. And I think we now agree that maybe these domain general mechanisms are like in the what we think of as in the OS, and they work on these specialized mechanisms that themselves can have their own mm-hmm. kind of mechanisms work, you know, processes working with them. So I kind of like the analogy. Yeah. I think it kind of works.
Like it. I think the other point.
The brain is an iPhone.
The other point that you make, right. though, too, about, you know, just there's not a one-to-one mapping between the idea of domain specificity and domain generality and something being innate. I don't think that either of those are necessarily innate. Something could be domain specific or domain general and result from something that is what we would consider in our definition to be innate, or those mm-hmm. could be learned mechanisms over time. So yeah, I think absolutely. That oftentimes we get caught up in that and thinking of them in the same way, that domain general means right. that it's something learned and domain specific means that it's necessarily innate, right. but that's just... Maybe that's our statistical learning from people's perspectives that have been written in papers right. that those tend to go together, but yeah, they don't have to be.
Right, and you look at Rene Barjon's work, and she thinks that there's plenty of learning that goes on that refines those core concepts, and evolutionary psychologists don't think that humans come with a preset list of ideas about what makes a good mate or how to be a good parent, but there are biases, there are, you know, sort of things that push you one way or another. So, but either way, you can make the same argument. So again, I think people try to push these domain specific and domain general, like the push everything apart, but I think they have more in common than people would like.
That's a human bias though, right? Thinking in extremes, dichotomizing everything.
But for me, you know, I feel like specialization would not have occurred over evolutionary time unless there was selection pressure to mm-hmm. do so. And for babies to learn that 1 + 1 = 2 at 3 months versus 7 months, probably not a lot of selection pressure there. In my view. Now, do babies prefer 3 cookies over 2 cookies? The answer is yes. And Lisa Feigenson has done some really clever studies mm-hmm. to show that. But that doesn't mean that they know addition or subtraction necessarily. It just means that they have a bias that three items of food is better than 2 mm-hmm. items of food. And that mm-hmm. potentially could be an evolved, you know, a specialized sort of an innate bias. But it doesn't mean that they can do math, for example.
Yeah. That's interesting and relates to last time, too, over some of that replication work of Karen Wynn's, showing that there was some evidence for a preference for just looking at more familiarity and more happening sort of at the same time, but that was part of the finding.
Yeah. Right. And Les Cohen has also showed that, mm-hmm. you know, babies look at more than less.
That's what we talked about. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. So,
And that's the argument. If you want to make the argument that babies can add and subtract, I think... Again, to go back to Les Cohen, you know, extraordinary, and then to go back to a mantra that we repeat, that we've repeated in every episode, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So it's fine to make these claims, but you need to have the right kinds of control. Your statistics need to be tight. I mean, like, you really have to present extraordinary evidence to convince me of these extraordinary
evidence. And something like that word specifically, I think, is what David was saying. Like, why do you move away from using mm-hmm. that word? Because the word within itself is such an extraordinary claim. Right, to claim mm-hmm. that, as some people have in the past, that something is innate, to actually say those words is so extraordinary that your evidence has to be over the top for that. And I don't think that exactly. right now there's a lot of people that wouldn't be convinced by anything. Never mind.
Yeah. One-tailed t-tests aren't sufficient to support the claim that babies get innocent. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I have not seen one study that really has affirmed to me that there are co-knowledge systems, for example. Like, Liz Spelke and Renee produce beautiful data, they're clever studies. And I think, as in most cases, it's all about interpretation. Mm-hmm. Like, what can you conclude from a set of data? And I'm yet to see a study that makes me think, okay, in this domain, I buy it, that there is a specialized mechanism, that there is some innate knowledge or whatever we want to call it. I think in the evolutionary psych world, there's more better evidence for that, right? So, I've done these studies with Feeler, snake and spider learning in babies. And, I have 5-month-olds who track snakes and spider shapes longer than scrambled versions of those images. And I can't think of another explanation for why they might do that. They don't do it for all biologically plausible stimuli. They don't do it for rats or sharks, because rats and sharks don't kill a lot of people every year. Sharks in particular, more people are killed every year by falling coconuts than by sharks. So, and we certainly don't have a fear of falling coconuts. So,
maybe we should.
But so, I'm yet to see, and I'm yet to see even someone claim in principle what evidence would look like that would actually provide sort of something that's convincing about core knowledge mechanisms.
I mean, and even if... Yeah, the problem with innateness, too, is that the term is honestly unfalsifiable. And the reason I say that is because if I say, for example, well, the evidence I would need to convince me that something is innate is that you would have to test newborn. Well, of course, an obvious rejoinder is, well, there's maybe performance limitations or process limitations that prevent us from actually seeing the mechanism in question. And so, like, you can always make these auxiliary appeals to these auxiliary assumptions and claims.
It's a messy term. Idea that learning starts at birth, right? Like, we have, I think, data to suggest now from, some really clever studies to show that there's prenatal learning, right? And so I don't think that even then, like, testing newborns still, like, then we could still say, well, that's not, still maybe isn't innate, that it's still from, a prenatal experience, so... I think that we need different methodology. Like, we need to evolve in the things that we're using as methodology, that right now it's very hard to make a claim that would support that.
Yeah, and again, have the different perspectives make very different predictions about what certain data should look like if we ran that study, which Dion outlined one example before. But when it comes to things like, object solidity or gravity or numbers, it's really not clear what these different perspectives, what different predictions different perspectives would make.
Given the complexity of all of this, as somebody who's really interested in pedagogy, that's my other area that we haven't chatted about. But I was interested in asking about then how do you... part of our job is research, but your other big part of your job, obviously, is mentoring students and teaching students. And how do you approach teaching complex subjects like this, either whether that's in mentorship of a graduate student or even in an undergraduate classroom or a graduate class?
What you do is you interview them and you ask them, the very moment you meet them, do you subscribe to the domain general position or do you subscribe to the domains? That literally was the question that David asked me.
Well, I do that in interviews because I think a lot of students who are applying for grad school don't necessarily understand that if they go to work with a certain person, they're buying into a theoretical position.
Yeah.
And I've had students come to work with me and I would sort of talk about these different perspectives, this domain general, domain specific view, and give them examples. And I'd say, look, if you come to work with me on issues to do with causality, for example, then you're going to be buying into this perspective. And, you know, they'll say, well, I'm also interviewing at Yale or Harvard or whatever. I said, well, if you go to one of those places, you're kind of buying into a slightly different perspective about how the mind works. And slightly. Many undergraduates are simply not aware that that's what is happening when they sign up to work.
Well, because, like, is that really... I'm going to take a tangent for a second and just say, like, is that necessarily how it's supposed to be? Like, if we're really in the pursuit of truth and knowledge, then should we be buying into a specific theoretical perspective? Or say, like, if a student came to you, even though you have a very specific perspective, maybe on, you know, infant's perception of locomotion, whatever. And I'm just picking mm-hmm. a specific example. But, like, yeah. if they were able to come up with a prediction that would, you know, that they could test a specific hypothesis that might disconfirm something that you believe, you know, are you going to say, no, well, you can't fine. Do that study? Like,
no, yeah. absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, I'd be okay with that. But you just don't want to be banging heads with someone for 4 or 5 years where you say, well, this looks like associative learning. They say, no, this is Bayesian. There's Bayesian, you know, learning going on here. So I'm open-minded. If a student came in and said, I've got this idea that would help separate these two views, absolutely, and I'd be open-minded about the results. But generally speaking, we want to work with like-minded individuals, right? I mean, I think that's how it is. And so one of my students this year was applying to work to go to grad school. She had something like 8 or 9 offers, but she was both applying to work with people like Michael Frank and Alison Gopnik, but also Deirdre Gentner. And so these people have very different perspectives about how the mind works, not entirely different, but somewhat different. And so I did try to explain to her, you know, if you go here, you're going to be working from this perspective. You go here, you're going from this perspective. And I just think it's important that students know that. I think it would lead to a more harmonious graduate school education if they know that that's what's happening, at least off the bat. Now, maybe they don't care. Some students are just uncommitted, and so they don't mind, and they'll just go wherever and they'll learn. But I think some students, depending on where they came from, like, where were you in undergrad, Candace?
I was at University of North Carolina, Greensboro. I actually stayed in the same... I'm an abnormality. Right, so I was in the same place for undergrad and grad. Right.
So you didn't have that problem.
No, I was Dion, very example, much familiar with my grad advisors.
Right, the work. Right. But Dion worked with Rebecca Gomez. Rebecca.
But she's on the same perspective. I mean, she's on the same continuum that we're on.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But you knew that.
But you knew that yeah. when you came to work right. with me, right. and you didn't apply to work, I assume, with some people who might have a very different perspective. Right. So.
Oh, actually, interestingly enough, I applied, one of the people the first person I emailed grad school was Les Cohen, and I think that was the year that he had retired, and so he was like, you know what, I actually have a fantastic person who, based on your interest, you even want to work with him, and, you know, he was like, oh, you know, go work with my former student, David Rackeson, but I did apply to work with Renee Bayerjean.
Right.
But again, at that point, I had a tenuous idea of the issues that we're discussing.
Yeah, here. I'm going to say, like, did you, I was going to say, did you have, like, a really strong, I mean, as an undergrad, and maybe I'm an exception to people that are applying to Harvard and Carnegie Mellon or Yale, but, like, I don't feel like I had a super strong perspective. I had some beliefs as an undergraduate, but I don't know that I would have had full insight into...
No, I had I think tenuous is a good word. Like, I had a tenuous idea, but nothing like what I have now, which I think was a good thing for me, right? Well,
I think I've been more successful with undergraduates than graduates, partly because we have a very small graduate program. But my undergraduates who've then gone on to, so I have, you know, undergraduates who worked in my lab who are now faculty include, like, Rachel Wu, Vanessa LeBou, you know, Vanessa LeBou at Rutgers. Who else is out there? Sloan, I'm blanking on her name. I have
Laura,
a bunch of
Lauren.
Lawrence, thank you. Lauren Crowstone.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody called Jamie Derringer, Vanessa, Rosanna, I'm blanking on that. So many names. Bro. And these students, particularly the ones who stayed in developmental, when they went to grad school, they knew what they were getting into. They generally went to work with people who had similar views on the world. So Vanessa LeBou went to work with Judy Deloach. Rachel Wu went to worked with Natasha Kirkham and Denis Marichal, among others. So I think that at least working in my lab, we talk about these issues in lab meetings, I have them read papers of mine and others, and I try and make them aware of these issues when they're going through their undergrad life. And I think, I'm not saying they're therefore more advanced, but I think situating the empirical work in a theoretical background is the best way to understand it. I don't imagine many people would argue with that, but I think a lot of people don't think undergraduates are ready for that. And I do. I think undergrads, particularly the ones who've been in my lab for 3 or 4 years, are ready to take on that kind of work. Interestingly, the student who came out of my lab this year, who's terrific, has gone to work with Michael Frank. So she's gone to the dark side, so to speak.
But you also then probably...
Although Michael Frank is probably closer to our perspective than you...
I'm just kidding. Michael Frank is terrific. I actually was very happy that she chose to go to
work. But you also probably then have those conversations actively, which maybe not all people do, and in a close mentorship. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important in the way that I work with... even undergraduate students now, and trying to talk with them if we have students that want to go on to developmental psych PhD programs, that we would probably, I'd have those conversations with them about, like, what would this look like? What would that look like? And students that don't have that, that's probably something important that you're doing for them.
Right. Exactly. I think having that knowledge helps them situate what they're learning, and also helps them decide what they believe. My student this year who's gone to work with Michael Frank, she's decided that she believes a certain way, something about the mind that, and I think that's great, but I don't think she would have got there if she didn't even know that the differences in those perspectives existed. Yeah. So to go back to your very first question, Candice, which was how do you convey these complicated, issues? I give students papers to read, and we have these kinds of discussions in lab meeting, in private personal meetings. Because, I think at CMU, but obviously at other places, we are very theory-driven, mechanistically driven. So it's always an issue that I'm thinking about, so I always try to convey that to my students.
Awesome. Well?
Yeah, that's right. So, before we go, I think we should this is what I wanted to open the episode with, but it's fine. This is a enough opportunity.
Just run it backwards. just run it backwards.
Yeah, just run it backwards. Yeah, right. So I was hoping that you'd be willing to tell our audience a bit more about yourself, where you grew up, what were, for example, your favorite subjects in school, what got you into developmental psychology, and then if you weren't a developmental psychologist, what would you be doing?
Wow, so many questions.
I know.
You can ignore any of the ones you don't want to answer. It's okay.
Okay. I don't think there was none. So I grew up in London, North London. And I went to a school at a public school, but what you call a private school. It's very confusing. Schooling's different. Yes, in England we have private schools, public schools, and then we have what you call public schools. Yeah, it's very confusing. Public schools you have to pay to go to, but there's an exam to get in. Private schools you have to pay, but there's no real exam, like you just need lots of money. So I went to what most people think of as a very good public school called Haberdashers Asks for boys. Sacha Baron Cohen was one of my schoolmates, who was Borat, if you remember him, among many, quite a few other famous people. So, and honestly, I wasn't a great student at school. I wasn't captivated by the subjects that they had to offer, your geographies and your histories and not really for me. So I was not a great student at school, but then I started reading about psychology when I was thinking about what to study at university. In England, you declare what you're studying as you enter the university. Mm. It's not like here where you spend a year exploring, and then you pick. In England, I was admitted to the psychology department at Warwick. So I became interested in psychology, and then when I got to university, it just came easily to me, right? I guess when you find the right thing, it comes easily, and history and geography and all that kind of stuff hadn't come easily. And maybe it's the same thing for you, but for psychology, it was easy. It made sense. So that was my background, and from there, I did my degree there. I took a year out, and then went to do my graduate degree at Sussex with George Butterworth, which was a great time. Graduated in 3.5 years, which is relatively quick, I guess. and then went to Austin to work with Les, and then Concordia in Montreal to work with D'Ampillon Dubois. So that was my route. That was some of the question. What would I be doing if I wasn't doing this? Maybe I'd be a podcast host. That's one option, I guess.
I was thinking like a footballer.
Well, my dream as a kid was to be a... He means soccer.
I was going
to
say.
For the American audience.
Right.
I always dreamed of being a soccer player, but I knew that I was never going to be a soccer player. So, I don't know. I mean, I really enjoy cooking. I would be maybe a chef, but that's a hard life. But I enjoy my food. Those would be a couple of options, I think. But it's really hard to imagine another career choice that would be as enjoying and satisfying as what we do, at least, you know, in terms of asking questions that you're interested in, you know, working with terrific people, you know, young people who with great minds, teaching, I find somewhat rewarding as well, you know, seeing students. No, I'm sorry, I maybe underplayed that. Candice is laughing because I said somewhat. No, I mean, I do find teaching.
No, well, the only reason I laugh is because I'm sure we all know, there are some people in academia who do not enjoy teaching and do not find it rewarding.
I do enjoy it. I do find it rewarding. It gets hard when you've been doing it a certain amount of time to keep your mojo, but it's possible. So, you know, a lot of people say to me how lucky I am to have this job. And I say, I'm not lucky because I went to school for 14 years to get this job. But I know what they mean. I mean, I feel like we are somewhat blessed. We get to do the work we want to do, work with great people, pick the hours more or less we want to work. So I'm not, it's hard to imagine doing anything else. What would your answer be to that, Dion and Candice? Have you already answered those questions?
We have not answered those questions
yet.
No,
we haven't.
Okay, I'm putting it to you.
Well, I will say that I am also very glad that I am a researcher and I'm in this line of work. For me, I get bored with lots of things. I can't imagine like myself sticking with anything outside of academia. And so like I'm sort of made to be an academic, the way my mind works, the way I think about the world. There really aren't many jobs that would support being able to entertain these ideas and being able to design experiments and to think deeply about this stuff. And that's how I've always been.
Well, I think if you're doing another job, you wouldn't be designing experiments. You're like, what other job could I design experiments and ask questions about the mind?
The boredom really is the issue. Like, I mean, I can't, I mean, outside of a think tank, I suppose. But so I guess if I weren't a researcher, developmental psychologist, what would I be? I mean, I would probably be a web developer, maybe, a programmer. So like
video game tester.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, so when I was an undergrad, to make money and like, this is what I would do to skip, like I would sometimes skip classes, I would actually build websites for local businesses. And I got into web development because my dad actually, like in his free time, he would do web development. And when I would go spend time with him in the summers, I would watch him and he would teach me different things. So I picked it up. So I would probably be a web developer. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine anything else.
Yeah, it's a good life. What about you, Candice?
So I guess I will give two answers similar to you, David, which is like, there's like the one that was my childhood dream of, I wanted to be a singer. I love singing. I play guitar. I love music. So like in some alternate universe, that was my dream. But the realistic world of had I not chosen this, probably, I mean, I've always loved education. And so when I first started, I'm a first generation college student. Nobody in my family has ever been to college before, not even for an undergraduate degree. So it was certainly, I did not go into undergraduate, like, I'm going to be a professor. I went into undergraduate expecting to be like a high school teacher. You know, that's sort of where I started out. And then, so probably something within the realm of education, even if it wasn't within academia, I think that that's probably fun alternate careers. Yeah, like more within the domains of music, but that didn't seem like a realistic occupation. So
I don't know. Maybe you have to sing on one of your these.
Right.
That might be another episode.
So actually, so I'd like to amend my answer. I think what I would have been is I would have been a forensic psychologist or some like so. What got me into psychology wasn't actually work with infant research or developmental psychology. It was the psychology of serial killers. And this is like when I was in high school, I used to like, I would spend all of my time learning as much as I could about different serial killers for some odd reason. I mean, well, one of the reasons my mom is, she's in the medical field. And growing up, that's what would be on TV, like stuff about hospital settings or stuff about crime. Mm-hmm. And so I was really, really interested in those types of things. That's like actually what got me into psychology. And so I imagine that if I weren't a development psychologist, I would probably be doing something in forensic psychology. So that's really what got me into
it. I could see criminal justice for myself, too. I think about that a lot. Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to sort of basic interests of, like, need for cognition. Like, I like to solve problems. I like learning about new things. And I like problem solving something. So, yeah, I'm definitely addicted to some forensic shows, you know, things like that.
And I had a particular bias. Like, I wasn't interested in all the serial killers. I was only interested in the ones with high aptitude, like, you know, Edmund Kemper is a good example. He's called the Co-Ed Killer. You know, Ted Bundy, which there's an interesting documentary on Netflix about Ted
Bundy.
I've
already watched it.
What did you think?
It was good.
I thought it was pretty good.
David Buss has a book called, what the hell's it called? The Murderer Next Door, Why the Mind is Designed to Kill. You should check it out, Dion.
I'll check it out, for sure.
Because evolutionary psychology has a lot to say about homicide. So, absolutely. It's adaptive in certain contexts. It's adaptive, right? So you should check it out.
Googling it.
If you're protecting oneself from threats seems like you'd be adaptive, but it doesn't seem like being a... I don't understand. In what way would being a killer be adaptive?
Well, you have to get rid of it.
Protect yourself.
Yeah, well, serial killers may be something different, but homicide.
Yeah, exactly.
Homicide generally
is pretty adaptive.
You know, to protect yourself, to get other people's stuff. You have stuff I want.
Yeah.
There's lots of reasons to use aggression, to protect, to stop people aggressing in the future, right? I think you're going to attack me, so I'm going to attack you first. There's all sorts of reasons why. But yeah, serial killing is potentially a different issue, well beyond the scale.
Yes, that's a whole other podcast episode.
Yeah.
You've got
so many podcasts to do. You're going to be busy.
Yeah. Whenever will I get some
Well, thank you so much for joining us, David. I've really appreciated all of your insights and conversation. I think it's been a really awesome episode.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great time.
Good
luck with the rest of the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Join us next time. We will be talking just DM.